Messiah or the high priest or Pilate or whatever. So it's their thoughts as they're going through circumstances and situations. And I would be glad to loan it to anybody or get your own. But I think it's marvelously done. And I'm trying to share some of this today. And we're going to read a lot of verses. I've asked Erin to help me out. She's going to read a lot of verses. But if we can go to the next slide, please. I want to talk about a little background, history, who the characters are, and then the trial. Very simple today. Luke, the next one. Boy, oh boy. All right, go to the next one. Looks really good on the screen. All right, one more in there. This will be better. We have, at the time of the Messiah, Palestine broken into different prefects or areas, okay? One of them was known as Samaria. One of them was known as Judea or Idumea. There was the area of Galilee. There was the area of the Decapolis. These were all regions. You could call them counties or states in our equivalent. So when you talk about who, for example, was king or ruler over Samaria and Judea, you would know that, oh, look who it's talking about. Who's over Galilee, which is a different area. And if you could see the screen better, you'd see the different colors and all of that. But what I would like to point out are a couple of key areas. One, here's Capernaum, Nazareth. They're in the area known as Galilee. This is the Sea of Galilee. This is where the Messiah did a bunch of teaching, walked across the water, the storms, the crowd. You know, Tiberias is on this sea that was founded in honor of Emperor Tiberius. But over here is Caesarea, right on the coast. Caesarea was the palace of the ruler over Samaria and Judea. He wasn't in Jerusalem. So the ruler of Samaria and Judea, in the case of the Messiah, Herod Antipas, he was one of the sons of Herod the Great. Remember, Herod the Great was the one who said, go kill all the children 2 years and under in Nazareth and in Bethlehem, and that was his father. But Herod Antipas ruled from Caesarea, which is 60-some miles from Jerusalem. So the ruler of that area lived 60 miles on the seacoast, fabulous palace and fortress right on the Mediterranean Sea. And then you have a ruler up in Galilee. Well, it just so happens that we'll go to the next slide. I'd like to talk about the character, because as we read through the story of the trial of the Messiah, these people keep coming up, and it's like really important to know their background and who they are, because it starts to spell out a picture of when the Messiah was teaching and he started talking about you hypocrites, you vipers, you dead men in whitewashed sepulchres, how you teach this and do that, how hypocritical they were. We're going to start understanding more about that. So what I'd like to do is start with Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate lived at Caesarea. He was in charge. Well, let's go to the next. Pontius Pilate. He was the fifth ruler of what is known as Judea and at the same time Samaria. He was appointed by Emperor Tiberius, and he reigned for 10 years. Most of the prefects didn't rule very long. They were exchanged every few years because the emperors would, it was a position of favor. But what made him interesting, as a procurator, he had control of the military and the law and life and death. His word was life and death to non-Romans. If you were a Roman citizen, you could appeal to Rome and go there. Paul did that, remember? Because the procreator or the prefect, he could not, but he had estimated 2,500 to 5,000 soldiers, Roman soldiers, under his control. What happens is all year long he lives over in Caesarea on the coast, but because the Passover was a time that the Jews were known to revolt, and they're very nationalistic, and that happened back in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and the Maccabeans and all these things, Rome was very sensitive to what happened in Jerusalem on the Passover season. So guess what happens is that Pontius Pilate, who lives 60-some miles away, brings all of his troops from Caesarea to the fortress Antonius, right next to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. He's there as the ruler of Jerusalem, as the ruler of Judea, as the ruler of Samaria, but he brings in all these thousands of troops to man up, because Jerusalem has 100,000 plus Jews coming in to keep the Passover and the feast. So he's there to keep control and order. He hates the Jews. He's the same age as the Messiah. He's in his early 30s. Nobody knows really his history, but he's trying to make a mark. So when he took over in 26 AD, as the first thing he did, he sent his troops into Jerusalem bearing the emblem of the emperor on their shields, and he hung them on the walls of the fortress Antonius. And the Jews revolted because it's blasphemy to have an image of something. Not even God wants an image. So here we have the image of the emperor in our city. 7,000 people picketed for days and days and days. And he sent his troops out thinking they were going to get in a fight and he could deal with these Jews. And they had been told, lay down on the ground and expose your necks and let them kill you, because we will not submit. And they called his bluff, because an uprising in Jerusalem in his first year of business is probably not good for his longevity. So he backed down, and he hated the Jews, and the Jews hated him because he was known to be against them. So here you have the guy, had full powers of life and death. He could reverse capital sentences passed by the Sanhedrin, which we'll read about, which is the Jewish rulers. He had to approve. So as you start understanding, why did they take him to Pilate? Because only Pilate could say, you live or die. They could recommend. What's also interesting is that he appointed who the high priest was. And the high priest in the temple wanted to wear the high priest's garments. But they were under lock and key in the fortress Antonius, except for the Passover period and the other holy days. So for the high priest to get his robes to wear for the high days, he had to go to the Romans and ask them. So it just showed how Rome said, we own you. The Jews hated the Romans. The Romans hated the Jews, especially Herod or Pontius Pilate. Now, he was now in Jerusalem at the Passover, having to come to make a show of force because these Jews were known to be rebels. He didn't want to revolt at his time, and that's sort of a brief background of Pontius Pilate. Let's go to the next one. Herod Antipas, King Herod. We read about him a lot in Scripture. Remember John the Baptist? Guess which Herod it was that he was saying, you are married illegally, because this Herod, the second son of Herod the Great, the one who killed all the babies, had been brought up and lived in Rome. And when his dad died, instead of he inheriting the throne, which was in his first will, his father rewrote the will and divided his area into four kingdoms. So Herod Antipas went to Rome to appeal. And while he was there, he met his brother's wife, Herodias, and he convinced her to divorce his brother. and he divorced his wife, who was the daughter of the king of Arabia, and they got married, and they came back to Galilee. And John the Baptist says, you can't do that. And Herodias, remember when her daughter danced for Herod? And he said, oh, I'm so amazed at your skill and your beauty. Anything you want? Her mom said, I want the head of John the Baptist. So guess what? Herod Antipas soured the relationship with all the Jews. Now, if you were to go to Luke 14, I believe it is, it talks about Pontius Pilate, who killed a bunch of Galileans when they came to offer at the temple. Well, guess what? Galileans were the subjects of Herod Antipas. So Herod Antipas has this big grudge against Pontius Pilate. Why are you killing my people? They're my people. You don't do that. So they had this little feud going, the ruler of Galilee with the ruler of Judea and Samaria and Idumea. So the background is, he plays a role in the trial, but he and Pontius don't like each other because of what happened in Luke 14, where Pontius Pilate slaughtered a bunch of Jews from Galilee who came down to worship at the temple. He also has much power. Well, I'm not even going to go through a lot of the history, but you get the sense. So you have a ruler of Galilee. Where was Christ from? Galilee, right? And you have Pontius Pilate, who's the ruler over in Caesarea. They're all down for the Passover where the Jews are. They're all down there to keep track of what's going on with thousands of troops and 100,000 Jews. It's like this big melting pot for revolt and ferment. And then you have this guy named Jesus who's stirring the pot with the people. Well, let's go to the next person. Annas. The interesting thing about Annas is that he was a high priest from AD 7 to AD 15. He was appointed by Quirinus, Roman governor of Syria, and then 8 years later, he was put out of office. Now, what does the Bible say about the role of the high priest? It says that they're there till death. Aaron stayed high priest until he died, and his successors, they stay until they die. The only way to remove the high priest from office is by his death. But the Romans said, no, 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 no. This is a political appointment, and you pay me, and you serve at my leisure. So what we have is, he was put out of office after 8 years. He was succeeded by three people, and then finally he got his son-in-law back in, just before the Messiah. And so what we have, when you read the history of Annas, five of his sons and his son-in-law all fulfilled the role of high priest. He made it a dynasty of his family. But we'll see what he did. Tenure of Caiaphas was from 18 to 36. So he was a high priest during, and for him to stay in power for 18 years meant a lot. Because usually this was a money position that, depending on who the Roman prefects were, you could buy and sell the position. Let's go to the next one. Caiaphas, this was the son-in-law of Annas. And so what you have is the Jewish people who say, wait, Annas was a high priest, he's still alive. In our minds, he's the high priest still. But the Romans said, no, we buy and sell this position. And Caiaphas, he's the one who now owns a position. So you have the people thinking Annas is, call him high priest emeritus. And Caiaphas is son-in-law, who is in the position. As official head of the Jewish state, Caiaphas presided over the council or Sanhedrin, its highest court. We'll talk about who they are. Next to the Roman governor, he was the most powerful man in Judea, and yet he was responsible to the Jews for the conduct, or to the Romans for the conduct of the nation. He was especially concerned about the popular enthusiasm and political unrest centering around the ministry of Jesus. Now, I'll stop here. I have a great program called Logos, and it's got the Easton Bible Dictionary, the Baker Bible Dictionary, the Lexham Bible Dictionary. I mean, you can go through and through, and this is sort of a compilation of a lot of that stuff. So if you want, I can point you to about 8 different sources, including who's who in the Bible. Because I like to know who are we reading about, what's their backstory. And it says, the high priest held office at the whim of the Romans, so Caiaphas' unusually long term indicates that he was a man of considerable political skill. Remember, his father-in-law got out at 15. There were 3 other high priests, and he came in at 18. So in 3-plus years, there were 4 high priests, and all of a sudden, he's in there for 18 years. The man's politically connected, very powerful, very wealthy, very influential. Let's go to the next one. When you study into the Sanhedrin, what you get is that there were 71 of them. They think that it started back at the time of the Maccabees with people who were zealous. Others say it started. But the point is, it was an aristocratic group. It was those powerful and influential and moneyed, the highest, the elite, as it were, is the Sanhedrin. There were 71 of them. And they were divided into 3 categories: high priests, elders, and the scribes. So to get in there, you had to be somebody special to be part of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin had a judicial group that consisted of 23 men. So out of the 71, there were 23. And for them to do the rule of law, the law said they must meet in public, during the daytime, in the specific court. They must bring witnesses before the accused. The witnesses have to tell the story, and then the accused gets to respond. Keep that in mind. The law of the Sanhedrin said they had to meet at a specific time, in a specific place, with a specific number, and they had to have the witnesses, and they had to have all this. That was the rule of law for the Jewish nation. Let's go to the next. We're going to read a bunch of scriptures here, and I've asked Erin to help me out, and she's going to be reading from the New Revised Standard Version, and I'm going to stop her because what I would like to intersperse are pages from this book, Killing Jesus. And if you're familiar with what a harmony of the Gospels is, I would recommend, if you don't have one, to get one. But it lays out all 4 Gospels on the same page in 4 columns, according here, the A.T. Robertson one, so that you can read about the same event in all 4 Gospels at the same time. Because what you will find as you go through this story of the trial of the Messiah, that each gospel writer brings up different information about the same event, so you need to read all 4 of them, and it's helpful because they're side by side by side. What I've done is gone through and picked out the path that gives us the most information, because sometimes there's only 1 sentence in one of the writers, and another time there's 8 or 10 from another, and they give all sorts of information that I think when you see the big picture, it's going to be very helpful. So what we're going to do is we're going to jump into this shortly. Now, let me read something to you if I can. This is some background. And this is speaking about the Messiah in the days preceding his entrance into Jerusalem. It says, this is how he sees many of the men who lead Israel as if there is no God. They are among the 71 men of the Sanhedrin. the 7,000 temple priests, the hundreds of temple guards, the seemingly countless rabbis, and the huge variety of civil authorities. That's what Caiaphas is over all of that, okay? And here's what they do. They determine what may be eaten, what may be sold, how far a man may walk, and on what days, who a man may marry, how he may bury her when she dies, how a man ought to pray, what his children may inherit, are all decided by the Sanhedrin and its army of ever-squabbling experts. So what we have is a group of people who control every aspect of Jewish life at the whim and pleasure of the Roman authority. Aaron, would you please read, starting there, John 18, 2 through 12?
Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, because Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas brought a detachment of soldiers together with the police from the chief priests and the Pharisees. And they came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that was to happen to him, came forward and asked them, "Whom are you looking for?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus replied, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they stepped back and fell to the ground. Again he asked them, "Whom are you looking for?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you are looking for me, let these men go." This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, "I did not lose a single one of those whom you gave me." Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it, struck the high priest's slave, and cut off his right ear. The slave's name was Malchus. Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword back in its sheath. Am I not to drink the cup that the Father has given me?" So the soldiers, their officer, and the Jewish police arrested Jesus and bound him.
What strikes you about that? The backstory is there are hundreds of men with him. Pontius had cut a deal with the Sanhedrin, and he sent his soldiers. But when they ask, "Who are you?" and he says, "I am he," what happened? They all fell back. So what I get out of this is that the Messiah let them come, because all he had to speak, and they were gone. He had the power to wipe them right off the mountain. And you would think that they were sort of stunned that he says, "I am he," and boom, they're all on the ground. And so what we have is a situation where he is taken. And I would like you to read, Aaron, as it were, John 18, verses 12 through 14 and 19 through 23. Now I want to stop you here. What time of the day is this? Night. Remember, he had had the supper with the disciples. They had gone out. He was praying. They all fell asleep. He prayed some more. They fell asleep again. Then this happened. So this is late in the evening. Is it 11 o'clock at night? Is it midnight? It's somewhere in the middle of the night, because they're coming with torches and all this. So keep the context. They had been up all day long. They'd had the meal. They had fallen asleep, he's praying, and this is somewhere close to midnight. Aaron, will you continue reading the next set of verses, John 18, 12 through 14?
Yes. First they took him to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest, that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was better to have one person die for the people. Then the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teachings. Jesus answered, "I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard what I said to them. They know what I said." When he said this, one of the police standing nearby struck Jesus on the face, saying, "Is this how you address the high priest?" Jesus answered, "If I have spoken wrongly, testify to the wrong. But if I have spoken rightly, why do you strike me?" Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest.
Okay. He got arrested, and they took him to Annas, and they had this dialogue, and then he sends him on. And all the years that I've read that, it's sort of like, well, okay. Let me read some things to you to try and give you some background of what was going on. And I, again, this is this author's putting into words their thoughts. But the background of what was at stake according to the Jews. This is speaking of Annas, the high priest emeritus, the father-in-law of Caiaphas. He's talking about the temple in Jerusalem is the key to all power. That's what Annas believed. If you controlled the temple, you controlled all the power. This seemed perfectly obvious to him. He marvels that so many fools fail to comprehend it. The temple is everything. The biggest enterprise, the holiest ground, the most revered site in the nation. How can a man know this truth and not make it his servant? The money alone that passes through the temple is nearly beyond belief. Every single day, great wagon loads of coins, tithes, temple taxes, and the tributes owed to Rome flow into the temple. She sits at the mouth of a never-ending river of wealth. For Annas, this means profit. He perceives the potential, and not just from the coins. There is also the trade. He understands what it means that hundreds of thousands of pilgrims make their way to the temple each year, each with gifts, each with needs. There are sacrifices to buy and coins to exchange in the official temple currency. If a person wishes to make a sacrifice, this is what is required. Always, though, there is a fee. Always there is a percentage for Annas and his family to claim. Even the sacrificial system offers opportunities. Cattle, sheep, olive oil, fruit, birds, grain, wood, cloth for vestments and curtains, gold for utensils, all must be bought, sold, and transported, stored, packaged, and made holy by the rituals of the priests. All of it costs money, and it can mean riches for the discerning, like Annas. He began to realize this years ago when the Romans appointed him high priest. It did not take him long to see the beauty in the system. In fewer than 10 years, Annas assumed control of the temple markets, made sure every transaction put money into his hands, and bought influence enough to even make the Romans nervous. The Romans, in turn, deposed him, unwilling to feel nervous for long. It did not stop the old schemer. He manipulated, bribed, and cajoled to make sure his sons inherited his position. And then he continued to run the temple like a personal kingdom. Now, his son-in-law is a high priest. Annas controls him so thoroughly that on the streets of Jerusalem, people speak of the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. Everyone knows it is Annas who rules. Still, he has never confronted anything quite like this current problem. A rabbi from the hills has come down from Galilee and caused trouble in Jerusalem. He has been making wild claims and persuading superstitious people to follow him. His popularity has become a threat. The people might rebel in this rabbi's name, and it would force the crushing hand of Rome. Annas is keenly attentive when a threat to his power looms. First, the young fool, speaking of the Messiah in his mind, first the young fool announced himself by riding into the holy city astride a donkey. He paid people to stand along the roads and shout, "Hosanna, blesses the coming kingdom of our ancestor David." The silly pretender was trying to declare himself king by doing what King Solomon had done a millennium ago. He even enlisted a deranged woman to anoint him at a public dinner the evening before. There were rumors that this holy man could heal. It was all a pretense, of course, but the people, ever eager for some new trick, believed in the rube and his magic. He pretended to heal even on the Sabbath and urged others to ignore the laws of Shabbat as well. He justified all of this by twisting Isaiah's Song of the Vineyard, using it to show that Israel's leaders were religious leaders were corrupt. Men should turn to a new law, the radical insisted. This sent the Pharisees over the edge. Annas is a Sadducee, though cool and broad-minded and doubting, so he isn't quickly stirred. Even when rumors arose that the backwoods rabbi raised a dead man in Bethany, Annas remained precise in his plans, measured in his words. He would not have the public or his enemies see him nervous. His patience paid off. This foolish Galilean couldn't help himself. He overplayed his hand. He made the move that confirmed to Annas what he was really up to. What the man truly had in mind, his accusations and his fake miracles aside, was a cut of the temple trade. That upheaval in the temple is what revealed the truth. It happened suddenly and on the kind of crowded, loud, chaotic day that always precedes the Passover. The temple courts were filled with pilgrims and money changers, just the way Annas likes them to be. The rows of Corinthian columns in the court of the Gentiles had proven a perfect arcade for the exchange booths. Pilgrims could convert their home currency into the official coin of the temple with ease. Annas delighted to see it. He was profiting from every transaction. None of the money changers conducted business without the old man's permission and without paying the old man's fee. In addition, there was a percentage he demanded from each exchange. It was a profitable arrangement. Annas also controlled each of the one approved to assure the Levitical fitness of animals for sacrifice. Somebody had to say, this meets the requirement. This too was profitable. The mumche, as they were called, charged a fee for his services, of course, and most were not beyond taking a little extra on the side to approve a damaged beast. It meant the owner could sell his finer animals in the market for profit and offer the ritually unclean ones to God. What was the harm? These dealings made the temple courts a great riot of trade, all orchestrated by the father-in-law of the sitting high priest. Men weigh coins, argue their value, make calculations, and grandly gesture in market dramas familiar through the centuries. It has been going on for so long that no one remembers when money changers did not sit in stalls behind great stacks of coins, when the protests of oxen did not challenge the sound of bickering men, doves by the thousands coo and sheep bleat, and the sound of men squishing their way through manure completes this profitable commotion. It is all music to Annas' ears. The old man is in such control of these stalls in the court of the Gentiles that people secretly call them the bazaars of the family of Annas. They mirror the family greed. Prices are inflated, the poor are targeted, the simple are manipulated. Always there's an extra percentage, the fee off the books, the kickbacks to the conspiring and powerful. Syndicates form, enforcers arise, arrangements are understood. It is the empire of Annas. That rabbi from the hills knows all this. When he stepped into the temple court that day and started his demonstration, he wasn't trying to bring reform. He was making a move for territory, an obvious grab for power. Feigning outrage, the intruder fashioned a whip from reeds he found on the marble floor and rushed at the money changers. He swung wildly with knotted reeds in one hand while he grabbed for change boxes and stacks of coins with the other. He flipped tables into the air with the strength of a carpenter's arm. Benches went airborne. Account books flew at bystanders. Terror filled the courtyard. Annas thought it was a criminal disruption of trade. The mad rabbi would not let honest workers carry goods through the courts. He sent merchants screaming and pilgrims rushing for safety. It was sacrilege. Sheep spilled out of their pens and doves flew low and loud into the faces of panicked men. Money changers racing for safety fell clumsily over their fellow merchants who were crawling on the floor to gather spilled coins. The man kept screaming about his father and a den of thieves and how the Gentiles were supposed to have a house of prayer in the temple of God. It was all a show. Annas knows what the man was really doing, moving into the high priest terrain, and it has to stop forever. He cannot let this man cut into his trade, cannot allow the people to be deceived. How would it look if he lost control to one of the countrymen, the word used, pagani, the Romans used for the people from the country. He has decided the matter. He has already formed a coalition. The Sanhedrin is no problem, for they will certainly follow his lead. They always do. Together they can move the blasphemer Pilate to use his supreme jurisdiction. The emperor gives him over the sentence of death to permanently silence this criminal. Finally, the righteous will be rid of distraction, and Annas's market will thrive as before. That's the background of Annas. So, as they take Christ captive, in the middle of the night, they don't take him to the Romans. They don't take him to the courts. They don't take him to Caiaphas. Where did Aaron read that they took him? They took him to Annas' house in the middle of the night, because he controlled the temple. He controlled the Sanhedrin. He controlled Caiaphas, the high priest. So where do they take him? So let's pick up there. Aaron, will you read Matthew 26:57, and then a couple more verses? Up there, follow that.
Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, in whose house the scribes and elders had gathered.
What does that say in my version? All right, let me stop. When you read, sorry, I'm ahead of myself, 19 through 23, it said they took him to Annas, right?
Yes.
All right, so let me read something that we've got with Annas. Let me point this out. Annas brings him there in the middle of the night, and he questions him. And we read, I believe, I got too many books here. Let me do this. We read that, what did we just read? Right. I thought we read John, though, just before that. Okay, in John up through 23, it said that Annas asked him questions, and he said, "Why have you asked me this? Didn't I speak in the temple?" And then it says that one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, "Answer the high priest." The issue is that according to the law, you could only be taken into court during the daylight, in a specific place, with the Sanhedrin, with the 23 in judicial court, and they had to accuse you, and then you could answer after you've heard the accusers, seen the accusers, and heard their accusations. It was against the law to strike a bound man. So what we have is a perversion of justice. And so let me find where... Sorry. This is the meeting with Annas. So you know the background of Annas. This is where we just read in John 19 through 23. He's taken to Annas' house. It says, when the time comes, soldiers shove him through the door of the house, wind through several of its rooms, and stop before a 70-year-old man. The two eye each other. Annas, ever cool and precise, speaks first. The guards remain at Jesus' side. Annas asks first about the men who follow Jesus. Doesn't it say here in verse 19, the high priest therefore asked Jesus of his disciples and of his teachings, like, where are your men? Where are all the people that follow you? He's there all alone. He's bound up. This is a taunt. Here before Annas is one who speaks to thousands from mountainsides and who was nearly carried into the city by masses of pilgrims at the start of the week. As a man much impressed with power, Annas took note. Now though this self-proclaimed king is bound and alone, Annas had heard from his guards and his servants that evening, perhaps also from Malchus of the severed ear. That was Annas' servant. Hey, do you understand what happened out there? How the men with Jesus had run. Annas delighted in the snide tale about the naked boy who scampered into the night. What happened, Rabbi? He did not need the information to help him arrest these men. That would not be difficult for a man with Annas' network of spies. No, what he wants is a moment to gloat. I got this rabble-rouser right where I want him, and he's going to die. Tell me, Rabbi, where are these men who hold you in such esteem? Not one is devoted enough to stand by you? He's taunting the Messiah. While Jesus stands, his hands tightly tied behind him, and Anna sits, smooth and mockingly polite, the questions turn to teaching. He has no intention of learning from Jesus. He is a Sadducee. There is nothing a Sadducee does not know. He probes. He feigns interest. He turns a phrase over and over for explanation. This goes on for quite some time. Finally, Jesus is no longer willing to accommodate the game. There are laws. Jesus said, I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in the synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. Jesus is not asking why Annas does not have better information. He is appealing to the mandate of the Sanhedrin's own laws. He is being detained, even bound. He has not yet been charged. Instead, Annas probes for something he can make into a crime. It is backward. Charges come first on the testimony of two witnesses, then the questions. But it transgresses the laws of God and man to use the latter in hopes of finding the first. What you are asking me about is already known. I've hidden nothing. Please bring out your case, is what Christ is saying. One of the guards thinks this is insolence and strikes Jesus on his face. For a Jew, it is a shattering insult. It is a violation and it is cowardly. Strike a bound man? Again, it signals what is coming. This is the first of many blows Jesus will receive, and not one of them will be justified under the law. If I said something wrong, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why do you strike me? There is no answer. Annas is bound by nothing. He owes this rabbi no explanation. He is accountable to neither man nor principle. He is the ruler of this land. Kings and priests do his bidding, and he intends to make Jesus pay. The law is a thing one uses to achieve ends. Jesus has cost him. This is what he knows. He will do as he pleases, and he is pleased to end this man's life. Both men see this for what it is. The meeting comes to an end. So then what does it say? He sends him to Caiaphas. So Aaron, if you would reread Matthew verse 57 and then Mark 14, 55 through 65.
Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas the high priest, in whose house the scribes and the elders had gathered. Now the chief priests and the whole council were looking for testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many gave false testimony against him, but their testimony did not agree. Some stood up and gave false testimony against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands.' But even on this point their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, 'Have you no answer? What is it that they testify against you?' But he was silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?' Jesus said, 'I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven.' Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "Why do we still need these witnesses? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?" All of them condemned him as deserving death. Some began to spit on him, to blindfold him, and to strike him, saying, "Prophesy." The guards took him over and beat him.
That's verse 65?
Yes.
Let me read something now, again, about this, where he's now taken to the high priest, and with him is the Sanhedrin. What time of day is it? It's still 1 or 2, maybe 3 o'clock in the morning. He's already been beaten by the soldiers at Annas' house. He's now marched to Caiaphas. Caiaphas has who? The Sanhedrin with him, the scribes and the priests and the Pharisees? It says, soldiers shove Jesus from Annas' presence and take him to the sitting high priest. Caiaphas is waiting elsewhere in the same house, and he is not alone. With him is nearly every authority in the nation, the chief priests, the Sanhedrin, minus a few, the elders and the teachers of the law. They have been waiting. They are eager to bring this matter to a close. As it happened before with Annas, the meeting does not begin with charges of wrongdoing, though it is the only legal way and what God requires. Instead, there are only questions. Jesus says nothing. He sees what this has become. It is useless to give an answer. Let them play this out if they can. The God of Israel is watching. Witnesses who have been well prepared give testimony, but their accusations are so confused, it is obvious they lie. Even the most creative-minded can find no basis for a charge. Frustration rises. Men glare accusingly at each other. There has been great effort to bring this moment about. Surely, after all that was required to arrest this man, they will not fail to even make a case? More witnesses testify. There is nothing of substance. It is late. This gathering is tiresome, and there is danger that Rome looks on. Perhaps now new testimony can bring this meeting to a close. Finally, desperate officials shove new witnesses forward. There is some eagerness, even excitement. It is not to be. These witnesses make a tired claim. He has called for the destruction of the temple and promised to rebuild it in 3 days. There is squirming. Priests look to each other uncomfortably. For some, it is humiliating just to be in the room. So pitiful are these proceedings. Conspirators, though they are, brilliant men are here. They can detect lies. They can discern character. They have spent their lives judging facts. They cannot be treated as fools. They know the differences between a truly treasonous act and a poetic, symbolic statement used to persuade in a speech. No one genuinely believes Jesus had made such a claim. He might be deceived, but he is not insane. Only a madman would claim to build the temple in 3 days. It is the best they have to work with, though, and Caiaphas, mortified by how the night is unfolding, works to incite the rabbi in some way he can use. Jesus says nothing. These men are condemning themselves. Caiaphas senses it also. He is jaded, but he is no fool. He launches into a frantic performance. They're in the middle of the night, in a place they're not supposed to be, asking questions. Everything they're doing is illegal. And Jesus is exposing them. "Are you not going to answer?" Caiaphas said. His voice is filled with mock pleading. Again, Jesus does not speak. He is not obligated to under the law. There have been no charges. There is nothing to answer, and tonight in this evil affair, there is simply no purpose. Caiaphas presses, "What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? There are eminent jurists in the room, but their gifts are not needed to know this is a mistake. The high priest should not ask the accused to explain testimony against him. It exposes the weakness of his case. It makes his sidestepping of the law obvious. It allows the accused to win sympathy. No one could answer such a question. The room fills with an embarrassment at what this has become." Caiaphas knows he must redirect. "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus need not answer. There is nothing about this gathering that is just. The law that should govern this moment, holy to a Jew as little else, is cast aside by the very men the nation looks to for justice. There are no charges, there are only questions in search of a charge. The meeting is at night and takes place in a private home. It does not convene at the chamber of hewn stone in the temple where the Sanhedrin is bound to meet. It follows an arrest arranged by blood money. Each of this is a serious, punishable transgression. In this room, each of these is ignored. Lies prevail, but the larger issue has become perfectly clear. The conspiracy to murder Jesus has moved unwittingly into the light. It is the almost perfect creation of the house of Hanan, the perverse dynasty of Annas. It is established. The proceeding has made it so. The law of God no longer rules in Israel, nor in the minds of these men does God himself. This gathering is the evidence. Israel is ruled by thugs. Power has replaced righteousness, and profit is its purpose. There is no reason to think otherwise. There is now no difference between Jerusalem and Rome. It says, no one is more certain of this than Jesus. He has been declaring it for years. In fact, this is precisely what has brought him to this moment. These men intend to put him to death. There is no law, no custom, no allegiance that can dissuade them. They rule unrestrained. Caiaphas is waiting. He asks if Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One. He pauses. The rulers of Israel hope this is the turn. I am. Two words, a statement of truth. In a house of lies, it stuns. Jesus is not finished. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. This is what Caiaphas has been waiting for. He tears his clothes. It's an official act. Blasphemy is present. A desecration has occurred. All must come to a stop until this wicked act is cleansed from the land. A high priest tearing his garment is meant to be a sign of grief. It is what righteous men do when the holy is touched by the unclean, when the character of God is assailed. Had grief filled these men in Caiaphas' house, had they wept and agonized at what a false prophet claimed, fallen to their knees and begged for mercy from an offended God, it might have hinted at true holiness among at least a few of the men in the room. It might have offered some evidence that there were more than criminals in robes. Yet there is no grief, there is no repentance, no pleading with God for the nation. Instead, the leaders of Israel conduct themselves like mercenaries in a rage. They shout that Jesus must die. It is what they hoped for when they first conspired. Now they spit upon him and blindfold him and command him to prophesy. They are relieved that the case is closed and furious at what this man has said. They strike him, they curse him, they do nothing different from what the criminals of Rome would do. The meeting concludes. Men congratulate themselves upon their successes. They will yet see this man die. Tomorrow they will enlist the aid of Pilate. For the rest of the night, Jesus is locked in the jail beneath the high priest's house. It is 3 a.m. on the 15th of Nisan in the Jewish year 3790, and Israel is dying. Aaron, if you'll go to Luke 22.
The Lord turned and looked at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word of the Lord and how he had said to him, Before the cock crows today, you will deny me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. Now the men who were holding...
Aaron, where are you reading?
Luke 22, 61-71.
Okay. All right, so we're breaking into the story there.
Now the men who were holding Jesus began to mock him and beat him. They also blindfolded him and kept asking him, "Prophesy, who is it that struck you?" They kept heaping many other insults on him. When day came, the assembly of the elders of people, both chief priests and scribes, gathered together, and they brought him to their council. They said, "If you are the Messiah, tell us." He replied, "If I tell you, you will not believe, and if I question you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God." All of them asked, "Are you then the Son of God?" He said to them, "You say that I am." And they said, "What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips."
Okay, that's what I had read. We just read that there. So now let's go to, I think it's John 18, verses 28. So Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin are done with the Messiah. They're saying, let's take it elsewhere.
Then they took Jesus from Caiaphas to Pilate's headquarters. It was early in the morning. They themselves did not enter the headquarters so as to avoid ritual defilement and be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?"
Can I stop you there? It's interesting that according to the Jewish oral laws, that if they set foot in the house of Pilate, a Gentile, they would be defiled. They could not, therefore, take part in the Passover. So they made Pontius Pilate, the governor of all Samaria, of Judea, who has life and death in his power, they're telling him, "You're an unclean person, you're a defiled Gentile, we won't even set foot in your house, you have to come out and meet with us." How do you think that makes Pilate feel? Who do these rabble think they are? I have the power of life and death. So he has to come out of his house at about 6 o'clock in the morning to deal with these people because they're too good to come into his own palace. So the context is that you have Pilate, who does not like the rabbis, who does not like the Sanhedrin, he hates these people. And now they're bringing him this man, and that's the context again. He has to come out of his palace early in the morning to deal with them because they're too good to come into his place. And it's the palace. Okay, Aaron.
So Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered, "If this man were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews replied, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." This was to fulfill what Jesus had said when he had indicated the kind of death he was to die. Then Pilate entered the headquarters again, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you ask this on your own, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate replied, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests have handed you over to me. What have you done?" As Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not from this world. If my kingdom were from this world, my followers would be fighting to keep me from being handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here." Pilate asked him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to my voice." Pilate asked him, "What is truth?" After he said this, he went out to the Jews again and told them, "I find no case against him, but you have a custom that I release someone for you at the Passover. Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?" They shouted in reply, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Keep going.
No, stop it. There. Let me read something, because Pilate just said, "I find him innocent. I find no crime against this man. He hasn't done anything that I can give him the death sentence for." Let me read something about this same thing. "It is also tiresome," speaking of Pilate, "the governor must leave the palace and judge the matter from an elevation of rock outside. He would not do it had the emperor not begun to soften on the Jews. Tiberius commanded his governors to do likewise. Pilate already has political problems in Rome. He does not need enraged Hebrews suggesting to the emperor that the governor of Judea is anything but compliant. He hopes to make a quick work of this. He seats himself, sees that a crowd is gathering. He suspects they are curious about the rabbi and sternly demands a report. 'What charges are you bringing against this man?' 'We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, a king.' The words are too well chosen. The clerics would turn him against this man. Pilate will not be so easily controlled. Take him yourselves and judge by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone." Good, a start. We want this man dead, and we want you to do it, Pilate thinks. You've stripped us of that power. Pilate wishes to investigate. He knows it cannot be done in front of this delegation. He rises from his seat and walks back into the praetorium, his palace. No Jew will follow him. He sends for Jesus. When the prisoner arrives, he can see nothing threatening. He already suspects that this man is guilty of no more than getting in the way of Annas' ambitions. An old story. Are you the king of the Jews? This is Roman bluntness. He has little patience for verbal gymnastics. Yes, it is as you say, the rabbi speaks plainly. It is a rare trait in Jerusalem. Pilate waits. Silence. Under Roman law, the accused must make a case in his own defense. If he remains silent, his guilt is assumed and sentence is passed. Pilate waits for the impassioned speech. Nothing comes. He wonders if the man understands this. The chief priests have made numerous accusations against him. To say nothing is to guarantee death. Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they are accusing you of? Silence. Pilate asks once more, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus speaks, "Is that your own idea? Or did others talk to you about me?" It is a matter of importance. Because what he's saying is, are you asking me this as a Roman? Is this your own idea? If so, you are asking if I am a rebel. Or did someone talk to you about me? Then it was likely a fellow Jew. And what they have told you is that I think I am the Messiah. The answer disturbs Pilate. He hears the insinuation he is not his own man, that he does the bidding of the chief priest mindlessly. Am I a Jew? Pilate asks. This comes in bitter tones. It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it you have done? My kingdom is not of this world, and if it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place. Jesus will not be lured into defending himself. Instead, he declares his kingship in different terms. Ah, the clash of the gods. Pilate knew it would come. You are a king then? You are right in saying I am a king. How unusual this man is to speak so simply in such certain terms. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this reason I came into the world to testify the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. What is truth? Pilate asked. The rabbi touches the anger, perhaps the disappointment in Pilate's life. There is weariness in this. The governor is a man with no faith beyond the one imposed upon him, divinity of the state. He lives in an empire that makes every new god its own, that absorbs nations by absorbing their deities. It has made Rome a roiling religious sea, a god for every occasion, an altar for every need, and a priest ever demanding offering. Pilate has seen a man kneel at an altar on the street and beg to be heard, though he does not know which of the many gods to invoke. How horrible that a man might die because he cannot keep track. And this Jew speaks of truth. There is no truth. There are only truths. These are fictions. The rabbi may be a fanatic, but the man has done nothing to deserve death. The governor returns to the raised stone of judgment. Again, he takes a seat. The crowd has waited. They grow silent, eager. The delegation of priests looks on nervously. What has transpired inside? Raising his hand as a sign of authority, Pilate declares, "I find no basis for a charge against him." The people shout. The priests plead. Then one of the voices rises above the noise. He stirs up the people all over Judea by teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here. Pilate has not heard this before, and now he sees the path. So he's a Galilean. The Jews confirm this, but they see their mistake. Their case is slipping from their hands. It is Pilate's deliverance. If this man has come from Galilee, then he is under Herod's jurisdiction. Perfect. Herod has come to Jerusalem to sacrifice in the temple. He has already been here 3 days. Let him decide the case of this Jesus. And so I think, Aaron, if we go forward, it will be about him being sent over to Herod. Now remember what we have. Herod and Pontius Pilate hate each other. And Pontius Pilate says, I don't find anything wrong, and I'm dumping this one on Herod because this is not my jurisdiction, and I don't want this headache. So he's passing the buck.
Do you want me to read that portion? Because that portion about Herod is actually starting in verse 6. As opposed to 13.
Luke 23?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him off to Herod, who was himself at Jerusalem at this time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had been wanting to meet him for a long time, because he had heard about him and was hoping to see him perform some sign. He questioned him at length, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the scribes stood by, vehemently accusing him. Even Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then he put an elegant robe on him and sent him back to Pilate. That same day, Herod and Pilate became friends with each other. Before this, they had been enemies. Pilate then called together the chief priests, the leaders, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who is perverting the people, and here I have examined him in your presence, and have not found this man guilty of any of your charges against him. And neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. Indeed, he has done nothing to deserve death. I will therefore have him flogged and release him."
Okay, and that was what verse?
16.
Okay, go back to John 18 now, 39. No. What we have, again, Pilate says, I don't want this headache. He gave him to Herod. Herod had never met him. He wanted him to do a miracle because Herod was trying to be a believer. He was in Jerusalem to sacrifice at the temple. And for some reason, the fact that Pilate deferred him to Herod, Herod took that very kindly, and they became friends after that, even though they were enemies. So they're like, okay, they're respecting each other. But again, Herod says, there's nothing wrong. This man is innocent. So now he's sent back to Pilate. Pilate again says, I find nothing wrong with this man. Now let me... What was the last verse you read, Aaron?
I don't know. 16.
It was about that he was going to be scourged, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to flog him and release him.
All right, let me read this. He just said, I'm going to flog him and release him. I'm going to read, it is cowardice that moves Pontius Pilate to order this scourging. The prefect has not even rendered a judgment in the matter of the Galilean rabbi, but still he orders the cruelest form of punishment, possibly shy of death under Roman law. The man's innocent, he said twice. Herod said he's innocent. He said, yet to satisfy you, I'm going to flog him, scourge him. Fear fills him. Fear of Caesar, fear of the Sanhedrin, fear of the people. This is speaking of Pontius Pilate. He will give the screaming masses a bloody spectacle, whether they want it or not. What he will not do is free this man. It would cost him too much. He cannot allow it, though he has already declared the man innocent. So this is what they're doing to an innocent man. For Pilate, this rabbi is a political problem. For his legionnaires, this man is an object of snarling hatred. He is one of the arrogant, idiotic Jews. He thinks he is a king and that God has chosen him personally to rule. There is only one God who lives in the true temple, the one in Jerusalem. This fool is even called the temple my house. What a disgusting piece of filth he is. He thinks he is some kind of God, and yet here his own people have betrayed him into the hands of Rome. His people, the chosen people, how the Jews insist upon such words, but they are small, divided, and conquered tribe. They would not even have a temple if it weren't for the generosity of Rome. Yet their leaders think themselves so much superior that this morning they refused to enter the praetorium for fear of being tainted. Rome is to be spat upon in this way. Rome is this unclean. Let this deceitful rabbi feel the wrath of an unclean Rome. It is a scourging Pilate wants. He needs blood on display. Those who heard him order it and who thinks he means something like the usual whipping are unfamiliar with Roman ways. This is a scourge, what the Romans call the halfway death. Its purpose is not to slice into a man for a while so he remembers not to disobey. No, a scourging is how Rome strategically flays a man so he is never whole again, how it rips bone and flesh. The soldiers act immediately. As soon as Pilate gave the order, they take the prisoner into the praetorium. Now the arrogant Jew belongs to us. Out of public view and with only their comrades to impress, they prepare to unload their range. At the order of an officer, guards shove Yeshua into a courtyard. They remove his clothes, thrust him against an upright post, and tie his hands to a ring that hangs above his head. This stretches the muscles of his arms, backs, and shoulders, positioning them perfectly for about what is about to come. The work of scourging is done by a lictor. He has been carefully trained. There is an art to this, for the Roman scourge is more than a matter of blunt force and rage. It is a matter of expert use of the flagellum, one of the most effective instruments of torture ever devised. Simple, ingenious, and cruel, this flagellum is a ring of iron or wood to which leather straps are attached. What makes the flagellum so horrific are the bits of sheep bone, rock, or steel knotted into each leather strand. Yeshua's hands are tied so that he is just able to stand on his own. Then comes the first strike of the flagellum. It is devastating. The lictor does not slap the leather against his victim. Instead, he swings his flagellum so as to partially wrap its straps around the victim's torso. Then once the jagged bits in the leather have bitten into flesh, the lictor yanks the flagellum in reverse. Skin tears, blood gushes, pieces of muscle and sinew, even chips of bone fly into the air. The body is torn apart. This is the purpose of scourging, to break a man, to shred him, to make him less than whole. With the second strike, Jesus can no longer stand. He is hanging from his hands, too stunned and weak to find his feet. The strikes come more rapidly. He does not have time to think. His mind blurs. Each knotted strap is like a gnarled claw ripping away fistfuls of flesh. A red spray hazes the air. Dozens of tiny pieces of the prisoner are flung about the floor. The lictor himself is sheathed, shiny and wet in the victim's blood. It is a badge of honor within his trade. After dozens of strikes, Yeshua's back, arms, chest, buttocks, and upper legs are shredded. They look as though they have just been plowed. Strips of flesh hang loosely, barely attached at one end. The Jews insist upon limits to such tortures. Their law forbade more than 40 lashes. The priests allowed no more than 39 in case the lictor miscounted. This, of course, has led to much debate and absurdity. None of this mattered now. It is the Romans who are scourging Jesus, and they have no such scruples. They scourge until the victim passes out. Then they splash the offender with water and wait for him to revive. When he does, they scourge him more. This is why it is called the almost death. The lictors are proud of their trade and observe exacting standards. The soldiers who look on appreciate the bloody distraction. They know nothing of the craft and standards in art. They enjoy the sport and the gore. There is another brutal factor that adds to this heartless treatment. I'm going to stop. Remember some of the messages I gave about the family of Abraham and about Jacob and Esau, and we had Isaac and Ishmael, and how the brothers hated each other, and how what we know is many of the Arabs are also of Abraham, but they hate their brothers from the line of Isaac and Jacob. This is a true fact when you go back to the Roman legions. It says there's another brutal fact that adds to this heartless treatment. The men scourging Jesus are soldiers in the Roman army, but very few of them are Roman. Most of Pilate's troops are local. It is the same with armies of occupation everywhere, for it is always cheaper to fill the ranks with auxiliaries from nearby rather than with costly troops from home. That is why most Roman troops in Jerusalem are not Romans, but Samaritans and Syrians. They are mercenaries. They care little about Rome or the honor of Caesar. What they do care about is their hatred for Jews. This means that Jesus is being scourged by men who despise him for his race, who want him to suffer horribly just for being a Jew. It makes an already bloody form of torture into a racist slaughter visited upon one man. Jesus has gone limp. He seems to be dead. The lictor looks to the ranking officer for the signal to stop. It comes. Their scourging has been savage. Some of the bones in Jesus' back are exposed. He has lost vast amounts of blood. His flesh is shredded as though a wild animal has been gnawing on him. He is ghastly to look at, nauseating even for those who have seen a scourging before. Pilate will be pleased. The prisoner's appearance is so horrifying that surely the people will see that he has suffered enough already and should not be put to death. Says Jesus is untied from the ring atop the upright pole. He immediately falls to the ground. Guards drag him harshly to his feet and hold him up so that the gathered warriors can have a look. Soldiers grunt their satisfaction. He is almost dead, though not quite. It is perfect. The lictor has done well. His comrades honor him and shake his hand. The soldiers are not done, though. There is fun yet to be had. Since the prisoner claims to be a king, the soldiers intend to give him the homage he is due in a style he will never forget. They summon the rest of their company and dozens more assemble. Word of the amusing farce spreads quickly. Quickly, someone finds an old sagum, the purple robe worn by an officer. It is perfect. Someone else twists thorn branches into a crown, making sure the unusually long spikes turn inward to better pierce the brow. When it is finished, it looks like a sadistic version of the laurel wreath that Caesar wears. A reed serves as a scepter, and once it is positioned on the prisoner along with his robe and crown, the game begins. The robe and reed are mere symbols for humiliation. The wreath of thorns, though it is a continuation of the torture, its spears are inches long, and the man who places it on the criminal's head presses firmly till most of the thorns have pierced the skin. Profuse bleeding begins. Blood pools in the eyes and in the ears and then dries. It flows down upon his neck and shoulders, blending with the blood already oozing from dozens of other wounds. The soldiers circle their dying prey. They laugh at the worthless Jew in his comically regal clothes and begin to perform a perverted version of homage paid to a king. "Hail, King of the Jews," they shout over and over again. They bow and chant and stand at full attention as if Tiberius Caesar stood in front of them. They roar their laughter to each other and they begin their chanting again. In time, this loses its appeal and the blows begin. Yeshua has been struck already today by one of the temple guards. That was long ago, before the scourging. It was nothing compared to a blow from a Roman soldier. These men trained for years in hand-to-hand combat. Their lives depend upon delivering jaw-crushing blows. Their experience shows as they repeatedly strike the grisly-looking, disoriented Jew from the direction he least expects. Before long, one of the soldiers picks up a staff and uses it instead of his fist. Swinging the weapon in great arcs, he brings it down powerfully on the criminal's head, stunning the man with its force. This continues blow after blow, first the wooden staff and then the fist. The soldiers can taste the bitterness of their hatred in the back of their mouths, much as they are doing during a battle. They sense energy flowing through them. Some are surprised at how it drives them against this one insignificant man. They spit upon the Jew, mocking the kisses offered to an emperor, and continue to bow and chant his name facetiously. Strangely, after all his tortures, the prisoner is still standing. The soldiers beat him with a reed meant to symbolize his scepter. Some king he is, a mere blow with a reed causes this man to shudder. An officer calls for the prisoner to return to Gabbatha, the pavement stone where Pilate sits outside waiting. The soldiers enjoy one final insult, a last blow or a fist or staff. Then they end their game. It is time to appear respectable. They wipe blood from their hands and faces, adjust gear, and straighten themselves as befits Caesar's men. They must not appear to be thugs. They form around the bloody ghost and prepare to appear before Pilate. The prisoner is now unrecognizable. Until he moves in some small way, it is hard to tell whether he's alive or merely balanced upright by the guards. He does not look human. He looks freshly returned from the dead. This is, of course, just what Pontius Pilate wishes. I'm going to stop there because over the years, as I have prepared for the Passover, I've focused on looking at me, which we're told to, understanding the bread and the wine, which Christ says, do this in remembrance of me. And I personally haven't taken the time to really evaluate what he knew was going to happen. The shame, the brutality, the torture, the abuse, the injustice, because everyone declared him innocent. And yet look what they did to him. So I marvel, and I ask you to marvel, as we prepare for this, to understand what he knew he was going to, and yet, in his mercy and his grace, on the cross, what did he say? Father, forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing. And yet he knew. And I think this, hopefully, will give you a sense of when it said that he actually shed blood in his prayers, asking God, is it possible to take this cup from me? And yet he ended by saying, not my will, but your will. And what I'm hoping is it will also help us understand as we go through trials, as we are going to suffer, that I doubt any one of us will ever suffer like our Messiah did. And this isn't even talking about the 6 hours that he hung on a tree, waiting to die, and yet forgiving. It's very graphic. It's so unjust. It's so unfair. It exposes the hypocrisy. It talks about so much that I had hoped today, and we haven't read all of the verses here, but just to help you as you read those verses in the future, to understand the background, to understand the reality, to understand the horror, the bitterness, the revenge that he experienced, to more fully appreciate the depth of that sacrifice. It just wasn't 6 hours on a tree. It was a beating beyond belief, a torture. And in every case, they broke the law. They defiled the law. They proved who they were. And even the authorities of the land said, this man is innocent. And I firmly believe that if you read the rest of the story, and Pilate says, I wash my hands, I'm clean. And they said, let it be on our heads and on our children. Part of me believes that's why the Jews have experienced so much persecution over the years. They said, bring it on. We'll take full responsibility for, it's my opinion, I can't prove it, but they've sure taken a lot of abuse over the years. And they welcomed it. And they said, we would rather have a murderer set free than this man over here. So I just ask you, as we go into this next week, as we come next Thursday, and we read about that evening, and usually we stop when it says they sung a hymn and went into the garden, to think, what really happened next? What did that man go through? What did he experience for us? What he knew he was going to do for us. And it just overwhelms me at his love and his mercy. And it makes me think that my life isn't so bad. And I thank him for that, for the blessings we have. And I hope it will help us as we experience our trials. He did this willingly for us. And that's, I guess, what I'm trying to get to, that if we understand fully what he went through for us, And even at the end, he forgave them. He forgives us because he loved us first. So thank you for allowing this to be a long one, but Aaron, thank you. I'm done. I encourage you to read it if you can.